night begins. Cause we're done this before, so you come on in. Make yourself at my home, tell me where you've been. Pour yourself something cold, baby, cheers to this. Sometimes you gotta stay in, and you know where I live. Yeah, you know what we is. Sometimes you gotta stay.
Very good morning to you on a Wednesday. Big headlines this morning. Dow's off. 450 points at the open, as they say in financial reporting. The president says we're not in a trade war. It looks a lot like a trade war, but it's not. I like his explanation, though. We're simply in the process of rectifying a $500 billion trade deficit that occurs on an annual basis with China. And it's long overdue. Okay? Yeah. So for all you free traders out there, if you are content with transferring the United States intellectual property and industry to China, that's what free trade means. Right. And again, if you don't believe me, check it out. Right? China has weaponized their economy. They use it as a weapon. And so this is simply the recognition of the obvious. So that's in the news this morning. On a sad note, in the last 24 hours, a Marine Harrier crashed on takeoff in Djibouti. It was deaded on the USS Iwo Jima, if I'm not mistaken. And the pilot ejected as it was taken off from Djibouti International Airport in Djibouti. So just after 4 o'clock local time. So the pilot ejected as it took off. And probably headed back out to the Iwo Jima, and pilot ejected is in stable condition at a medical facility, at an American medical facility in the region. Injuries were reported to people on the ground. The second story is worse. Overnight, a CH-53 Echo went down in outside of El Centro, and four Marines on board there, and so no comment relative to what happened yet, as is customary, and but a it was on a routine training mission. All four crew members are presumed dead. The Super Stallion crashed near the city of El Centro around 2:35 yesterday afternoon, according to a statement from the 3rd Marine Air Wing. Obviously, the cause of the crash is under investigation. Nobody's been identified. And these are the first Class A mishaps since the, at least in one article I read, since the C-130 went down with the loss of, 13 Marines on board. So again, thoughts and prayers go out to the families involved, and we'll stay tuned. Obviously, it'll take months unless something leaks out in the press. I'm just trying to find the article that I saw earlier today that talked about Here's the article that I saw. No, it wasn't. It would be the deadliest crash for Marines since the KC-130 Tango transport plane went down in July near the Mississippi Delta, killing 16 on board. Not a good 24 hours for Marine Corps Aviation. So we'll keep you posted on details from that. I'll tell you what we're going to do today. One of the things I enjoy about this program is there's power in audio. And one of the things that I enjoy doing, and I'll do it today, is there's pieces of audio that are out there that are incredible. And yet, a lot of people have not heard them in their entirety. They hear little clips of them. For instance, I think most of us have heard the clip, you know, I know you have. So, Martin Luther King's speech, his I Have Been to the Mountaintop speech that he gives the evening before he's assassinated. And the whole reason that he's in Memphis, he went there to support sanitation workers in their strike. So you'll hear that speech today. We'll do that at the bottom of the hour. And, one of the things, if you've never heard that speech, or if you've never heard I don't mean snippets, but if you haven't heard the whole thing, he's a phenomenal speech maker, and Martin Luther King, and the whole speeches are incredible. So you'll hear that today, and then it's Wednesday. What I was going to do today was, on the heels yesterday, I played the Stephen Foley interview that really is incredible kind of Marine Corps history in terms of the renaming, the re-identification of Marines in that photograph, in Joe Rosenthal's photograph of the second flag raising, right? So Stephen Foley, his story is incredible, right? His Iwo Jima fetish, he's on disability, and he notices things that just don't look right. And I even recalled it wrong. What he sees in video taken of the flag raising, not in still pictures, but in the video images, is that after the flag's put up, the person that's supposed to be John Bradley turns, and it's clearly not John Bradley. You can understand the scrutiny. So then he begins to look at other pictures. What does Bradley look like? What does this guy look like? And so then he sees the compelling evidence, the more compelling and more obvious evidence of Bradley's uniform, being a corpsman, different, blah, 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 blah. And so it was very interesting for me to sit there and listen to the interview again and recall the things he had said. So Wednesday's Battlefield Studies Day. And so I was going to kind of hit a pause button on that, and what I wanted to play was after Foley came on, we had the director of the Marine Corps Historical Division, retired Marine Lieutenant Colonel Charlie Niemeyer, who's a PhD in history. He joined the program, and he talked about the process that the Marine Corps went through in terms of validating, in terms of what they did and how they did it. And so I was going to play that today because I thought it would be pretty cool to hear that on the heels of Foley. But because it was Wednesday, I thought I'll play Niemeyer's interview tomorrow. But the one I want to play today in light of Battlefield Studies is kind of go back to Tet, back to Hawaii, and I did an interview with General Christmas. I want to say in November of 2016, and it was the second interview we did. In the first interview, his career is too big, and so to talk about Hawaii and his career and all the things he did in his career, you can't do. So I asked him, would you mind coming back? He said, not a bit. So he did come back, and we talked specifically about Tet. And oddly enough, it's on the day after Donald Trump is elected president. So at the start of the interview, he and I talk about that first. And so so you hear that, and then he begins to talk about Vietnam in 1968, what he was doing, the initial reactions to all the fighting during the Tet Offensive was to make sure bridges stayed secure and in the hands, and Route 1 that was so important to the logistical effort and the sustainment effort of Marines and soldiers through Vietnam, that Route 1 stay open and that key infrastructure, bridges, stayed in the right hands. So anyway, he kind of walks you from that into Hawaii. He's the CO of Hotel Company, 2nd Battalion, 5th Marines. His battalion commander is Ernie Cheatham. And Cheatham had been a football player in the National Football League for the Pittsburgh Steelers. And so it's very, very interesting to listen to General Christmas talk about him. So you'll hear that today as part of our battlefield study. And, again, Tet is essentially two fights. South of the Perfume River, where 2-5 was, as General Christmas will describe it, it is kind of the French Quarter. It's where the university is. It's where Ho Chi Minh was educated. It was where General Giap was educated. So it is, and then north of the river is the old Imperial City, designed to emulate the Imperial City in what was known as Peking at the time. You know, if you said Peking to your kids, they wouldn't even, they'd look at you like, what? What are you talking about? Yeah, Peking, the capital of China. They would have no idea what you're talking about. So you'll hear General Christmas today in terms of battlefield studies. And he, obviously, a legend in the Marine Corps. And let me see if he'll come back a third time and talk about Hawaii. And then the other thing you hear him talk about, and he was one of the movers and shakers, and one of the originators of the idea of this National Museum of the Marine Corps. And so it's very interesting in that interview when you get a chance to talk to a guy like that and who helped conceive it. And when I asked him, did you ever conceive that it could become what it is today? And I think you'll find his answer interesting, because they truly, those guys hit it out of the park, absolutely positively hit it out of the park. So I have to, and then one other thing before we get going and check some news headlines is I have to tell you a funny story. Yesterday, you know how Mike says that I'm not going to talk about baseball until July. So, evidently, Mr. Potato Head, a little bit bored in Texas yesterday, I get a text message. Hey, I see the Yankees are one game behind the Red Sox. Interesting. I'm like, oh, here we go. So, I can't remember what little delicate piece of information I sent back the other way. And then Napa Man the guy who doesn't wear Uggs, who was accused of wearing Uggs but doesn't. Napa Man, he bumps in. Hey, it's a little bit early. I don't think we can sustain this level of hate for an entire season. To which I responded, are you kidding me? I personally have enough hate to power the Baltic states. And then Montana Man, he piles in. Yeah, Napa Man, I don't know who you think you're speaking to, but there's enough hate in this little forum, right, to power the enterprise forever. I don't know what he said. So we got that straight, which is actually pretty comical. And then Montana Man, he's been out doing a lot of ranching lately. So he played the victim card. Yeah, he's trying to find the Red Sox game because he's a Red Sox fan. So I'm in the supermarket shopping. This is awesome. I'll tell you the full story. So Gunner's he's trash talking like, oh, the Red Sox they're dominating. That's what he tells me. They're dominating the Marlins. So I didn't even look at the score. I'm going to go work out. The Yankees win. And then when I look at the Yankees' final score, for whatever reason, I see the Red Sox, who are dominating the Marlins, except the score is tied 1-1. So I said, like, you butthead, what are you talking about, dominating them? The score's 1-1? So anyway, the Red Sox go up. Next time I check it is when I'm working out, and it's 2-1 in the 12th inning. The Red Sox just went ahead. So I finish my workout. I hop in the pool, fully expecting to get, you know, to get out of the pool with a whole bunch of text messages. And what happens? Miami ties it up 2-2. Now they're in like the 13th or something. Now the Red Sox ultimately won, but it was funny. It was funny. So, but yeah, a little happiness. And so then I'm in the supermarket. I'm laughing. You know how you have your headset on and you'll be doing something and you're laughing and people are. That's what was going on. That was what was going on with me. Then the inmates, after the Red Sox won, then the inmates had to, like, get their little pound of flesh. So, anyway, yeah, baseball season started. So, good morning to you. Welcome to All Marine Radio on a Wednesday hump day across the world, wherever we celebrate it. And the United States Marine Corps Band makes it official. We'll check news headlines here in a few minutes. So, you're going to hear Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream. No. I've been to the mountaintop. 50 years ago today, he was assassinated. And then, what, April, May, June, less than 60 days later, Bobby Kennedy's assassinated. So, if you can recall, anybody who recalls the 70s, late 60s, and says, oh, that was so cool, it really wasn't. The culture was actually it's reminiscent of what's going on today. You know, the culture was so stressed, and the differences so marked that it was not a fun, cool thing. It was not a fun, cool thing. And so, 1968, not a good year when you look back on it. So anyway, but the reason I love, and Martin Luther King in particular, his speeches are awesome. Honestly, if you listen to his "I Have a Dream" speech, and I've said this before, but he gives speeches, and like any speech maker, you know they use little bits of different speeches in a lot of their speeches, depending on who they're speaking to, and. You hear common themes, but he's so eloquent in terms of the way he takes you through this journey and down this road, this oratory road that he takes you on, and the vividness that he puts into his speeches, and it was a gift that he had starting when he was a young guy. So you'll hear that. You'll hear, Lieutenant General Ron Christmas talking about Huey and national. Well, actually, he talked about the election, and then he talks about the Tet Offensive and Huey City, and then the National Museum of the Marine Corps on our battlefield study today. So sit back, relax, and enjoy the morning. Good morning to you. This is dedicated to Lieutenant General Ron Christmas, who not only incredible career in the Marine Corps, but just as incredible of a career outside. Whenever you speak to him, he is a he's a classy man, and he kind of oozes dignity when you're around him. Or if you go on YouTube and see him speak, you get that sense throughout, but his contribution and the contribution that he and his peers made with the vision of the National Museum of the Marine Corps that will give back to the nation and educate people about what the Marine experience is, what the Marine contribution to the nation has been over centuries, and so it's dedicated to him.
Can do for you, ask what you can do for your country.
My fellow Americans, I'm pleased to tell you today that I've signed legislation that will outlaw Russia forever. We begin bombing in 5 minutes.
Let me be clear. As hard as the last 16 years have been on our military, no enemy in the field has done more to harm the readiness of the U.S. military than the combined impact of the Budget Control Act's defense spending cuts, worsened by the by us operating in 9 of the last 10 years under continuing resolutions, wasting copious amounts of precious taxpayer dollars. If you don't get the resources, my closing words, then your strategy is nothing more than a hallucination, because without the resources, there's just so much brave young men and women can do.
What keeps you awake at night?
Nothing. I keep other people awake at night.
We just have to execute. And we are executing every day, and Sergeant Major, I'm very proud of what you do. Doesn't mean we can't get better. We don't want to make a mistake to learn. We don't want to lose to learn. We cannot lose if we have to go fight. We got to do what these Marines did here 75 years ago. Persevere against difficult, challenging conditions and odds and win. You got to win.
All right, check the weather. Currently 70 degrees in Quantico. Whoa. With cloudy skies, Camp Lejeune, same 70 degrees with those same cloudy skies. Granbury, Texas, cooled off. Mostly sunny in 46. Montana's warmed up. Cloudy in 36. 29 Palms, sun in 59. Pendleton, clouds in 54. Okinawa, dark, cloudy in 71. Marja, clear, dark, 86. The home of All Marine Radio. Mostly cloudy, 56 degrees. Looking for a high of 67 degrees. 67 tomorrow, both days with clouds. 68 on Friday. What is up with this garbage? Anyway, that is a look at your weather. We're going to check news headlines without a break. So we'll kill the music. We'll check some news headlines as we get going here. Top story on Marine Corps Times is Marines 4 dead in a CH-53 crash. If you're just tuning in, happened in the El Centro vicinity. It's an Echo model, which we all know is being replaced by the Kilo model. And so, again, no word out of the Marine Corps yet, and from any other reporting, the crash occurred at 2:35 local time, according to the 3rd Marine Air Wing in a statement yesterday. It was presumed that all four were dead, and names were being held pending notification of the of their next of kin. In terms of the 53, 12 Marines were killed in a collision, which again, pilot error. As opposed to pilot error, as opposed to, you know, a malfunction where there's no collision. So that was January 2016. In October of 2017, a CH-53 crashed in Okinawa that led to the Marine Corps temporary grounding the Japanese-based fleet. No, and there's no mention in the article whether it was a Delta, and there's a few of those still flying. Or the Echo. No service members were injured in that crash, which destroyed the aircraft. So, again, we'll wait for the Marine Corps, but these things take months. Normally there's no initial, unless it somehow involves civilian agencies, there's usually no initial statement about communications from the aircraft, whatnot. So, anyway, thoughts and prayers go out to four families who have lost a loved one. So that stuff sucks. And again, not exactly sure in terms of causes, and we won't be for months. The other story was a Harrier crashed taken off from Djibouti International Airport, and part of the Mew that flies off the debt that flies off the USS Iwo Jima. And the pilot is in stable condition at a U.S. military facility in the vicinity. The aircraft obviously crashed, and there was no civilian injuries. The kind of a interesting this has to do with headline writing and what the Marine Corps has gone out of its way in spite of headlines that were written. And it was interesting because when you read the headline, the article was different than the headline, which happens often in the news business. And so, you know, you'll read a headline, then you read the story, and you'll say, that's not, the headline's not right. So the headline was that the Marine Corps had changed its tattoo policy for, had changed its tattoo policy for reserve Marines. And the policy, and the Marine Corps clarified, the policy didn't change relative to what you're allowed. The only change was that somebody lower in the food chain would be able to grant the waiver. Okay, that would be the change. So interesting. Marine Corps reacts to an erroneous headline. And then what happens when somebody writes that headline? The thing is spawned around the globe. So anyway, the information fight that the Public Affairs Office fights. The all right. Let me cover one more story. China's defense chief calls his trip to Moscow a signal to the U.S. There you go. China's new defense minister says his visit to Russia is a signal to the United States about the increasingly close ties between Moscow and Beijing. Yep. I'll tell you, if you didn't see the press conference that the leaders of the Baltic states held with President Trump yesterday, very interesting. Very interesting. They sit on Russia's border, right? So they're very adamant about America being an ally, about not only business ties but security ties, and missile defense batteries to be deployed to their countries, as well as the United States delivering liquid gas, which would decrease their dependence on Mother Russia for that asset. So very interesting little press conference yesterday. And it's kind of interesting that this China's defense chief's article, you know, happens at the same time. So we're headed for a confrontation with the Chinese, and it's necessary. And it's necessary that really what is going to happen is the nations, and specifically in the Western Pacific, Australia, Japan, South Korea, Taiwan, are going to have to decide whether they are going to stand up and push back against China's bullying. In right now, it's the Western Pacific, but China has every intention of extending that sphere to the Central Pacific. Yeah, as they assert their global dominance as they see it. So very interesting. Top five stories on the early bird this morning are this price tag to the Pentagon's major weapon systems, I can say it, grows by 10% from $1.74 trillion to $1.92 trillion in projected costs. Trump will send U.S. military troops to guard the U.S.-Mexico border. Initial reports is that the idea being floated, much like President Obama did, much like President Bush did, which is to send the National Guard to the border. Third story, uncertainty about Senator McCain's future fuels GOP question about his Senate seat. So in what will be a very contentious, and what people are saying are going to be very close races throughout the country, Senator McCain's seat due to his health in question. Pentagon formulating a plan to move F-35 management from a central office to the services. The Defense Department plans to dissolve the F-35 Joint Program Office and revert to a more traditional management structure where the Air Force, Navy, and the Marine Corps all run their own programs eventually. That's what that's about. And the ongoing battle at the VA is the fifth story in the early bird. Vets groups want the acting VA secretary out, calling his assignment a legal worry. Officials from one of the nation's largest veterans groups are calling for President Donald Trump to remove the acting Veterans Affairs Secretary from the post and instead hand over control to the department's deputy secretary, saying that is what the law calls for. So, again, the I don't know, the drama at the VA very much coming into very much, you know, on at least on a weekly, if not these days on a daily basis in the news. Leaders for AMVETS on Tuesday sent a letter to the White House insisting that the change is needed to calm fears of veterans and VA employees in the wake of the firing of Dr. David Shulkin last week. Shulkin, who had been one of Trump's closest cabinet members for much of 2017, was dismissed after months of controversy surrounding a watchdog report accusing him of ethics violation and then subsequent infighting among political appointees in the, from the administration. Following Trump's firing, following Shulkin's firing, Trump nominated White House physician Ronnie Jackson, admiral type, as the next VA secretary. And then nominated an Undersecretary of Defense for Personnel and Readiness, Robert Wilkie, to serve as acting secretary until the confirmation process is complete. But the announcement bypassed VA Deputy Secretary Tom Bowman, who was the next in line to take over the top leadership post. White House officials have not addressed the legal justification for the move, just saying that Wilkie has been working in the role since last Thursday. AMVETS goes on to say, quote, Tom Bowman is the person veterans need running the VA in this time of turmoil. Tom is a retired Marine Corps colonel, highly respected on Capitol Hill and well-regarded in the veterans community. This needs to happen now. Bowman was also the subject of possible firing rumors earlier this year as opponents of Shulkin within the administration wrestled with how to deal with the high-ranking VA officials who saw as opposing sweeping reform proposals to the department. That made no sense to me. Under current law, the president can fill leadership vacancies with any individual in cases where the current office holder resigns or is unable to perform the job. White House officials have said that Shulkin offered his resignation at the request of the president last week. But Shulkin, in numerous media appearances since then, has insisted he did not step away from the job voluntarily. I came to fight for our veterans, he said on Meet the Press, and I had no intention of giving that up. There would be no reason for me to resign. So, more drama at the VA. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, you're going to hear Martin Luther King. And then on the tail, on his coattails, at the end of his speech, you'll hear our battlefield study today. We'll go back to Hue, and you'll hear Lieutenant General Ron Christmas, who was Captain Christmas. He was the CEO of Hotel Company, 2nd Battalion, 5th Marines. Ernie Cheatham was a battalion commander, Big Ernie, as he was known, later Lieutenant General Ernie Cheatham. He was a battalion commander, so General Christmas, in a very, very interesting interview that we did a year and a half ago. All right, so don't touch that dial. More of All Marine Radio coming up next.
You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
I'm friends with the monster that's under my bed. Get along with the voices.
All you veterans, listen up. This is Bob Nielsen, former Marine and founder of the 100 Entrepreneurs Project. Turner Construction is looking for veterans with real-world leadership experience to join their team of professionals.
Hold on, Nielsen. Are we talking about a job or a career?
Not Turner Construction is a great company with global opportunities for veteran leaders who are looking to start professional careers. I know. I returned to Turner after I got back from Vietnam and retired after 50 years. I had a great career traveling the world leading teams of Turner employees as we built incredible projects.
Are they looking for me to have construction experience, Bob?
Absolutely not. Turner is looking for leaders who have led under pressure. We want leadership. So if you're led in Iraq or Afghanistan or any other contingency, Turner Construction is actively looking for you.
So, a career with competitive pay, good benefits, and a company seeking veteran leaders. That's what we're talking about.
Bingo. We're on the right road when a grunt can understand it. Good job, Mac.
I appreciate that there, Nelson. How do I get the ball rolling? What do I do?
Just email your resume to jobs@allmarineradio.com, and I will personally contact you and we'll begin the process.
I love it. Turner Construction is looking for veteran leaders who are looking for careers to join their veteran-friendly team. Email Bob Nielsen at jobs@allmarineradio.com. Let's do it.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
This hour of All Marine Radio is brought to you by our friends at Battle Mug, home of the world-famous Battle Mug. Starts as 10 pounds of aluminum. It's milled, machined, anodized, adorned with Picatinny rails, and then stamped with the serial number, and it's ready for you to make your own. Anything that went on your rifle or pistol can go on your mug. Scope, laser, camera, light. Put a lid on it, and you're ready for the field. If you're inside, add a flag and an emblem, and you're set. Perfect for any commemorative event. Farewell, promotion, retirement, birthday, anniversary, or get out of the doghouse. The Battle Mug is the perfect unique gift. Check out the entire line of product at BattleMug.com. Enter the promo code Marine for 15% off. Battle Mug is a veteran-owned and operated company. The product is made entirely in the United States. Check it out. BattleMug.com.
All I can say...
We all have the ability to touch the lives of those around us. Moms, dads, neighbors, teachers, friends. These are the people who are always there to listen when we need to talk. Though their actions may not always be monumental, they are always felt. To someone going through a difficult time, a text, a call, or a visit can mean so much. Reach out to the veterans in your life today. Let them know they're not alone. One simple act can make all the difference. That's the power of one. If you're a veteran in crisis or know one who is, visit VeteransCrisisLine.net for free 24/7 confidential support. Or call 1-800-273-8255 and press 1.
You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
I'm friends with the monster that's under my bed. Get along with the voices inside of my head. You're trying to save me, stop holding your breath. And you think I'm crazy, yeah, you think I'm crazy.
I wanted to fame, but not the cover of Newsweek. Oh, well.
It's just an interesting little observation here. Have you ever... and I just saw the commercial. It played on, I think it was Fox News, but the MyPillow guy, right? Everybody familiar with the commercials? MyPillow guy? Very, very overtly wears a crucifix or a cross. You don't see that often. You see some people wear it. You see it in a baseball game where you see a lot of Latin players who are raised devoutly religious. They have crucifixes around their crosses around their necks. But not so much when you're branding a product. So just a little interesting observations, things you don't see often anymore. All right, as I said, Martin Luther King. He was assassinated 50 years ago. And for those of us who are old enough to remember the amazing events of 1968. So you would have Martin Luther King be assassinated, Bobby Kennedy be assassinated, and then you would you'd also see the Democratic National Convention on TV and the violence that rocked Chicago as Mayor Daley's police sought to keep law and order, the rioting that took place. And it was, it was a crazy, crazy year. And I was 11 years old. Also in 1968, you had, in January, North Korea captured the USS Pueblo, a signals intelligence, ship that was operating in international waters off the coast. And, and the Koreans captured it, paraded the ship and the crew on TV. So, that's how the year started, 1968, in February, in late January and February and, early March, you would see, the war in Vietnam explode as North Vietnam launched the Tet Offensive. That would be ultimately destroy the Viet Cong as an organization and be an incredible loss, militarily for the North Vietnamese. Today, 50 years ago, Martin Luther King was assassinated in Memphis, Tennessee. You'll hear the speech that he gave the night preceding, his death, on June 5th. So a little bit more than 60 days later, Robert Kennedy was assassinated. After the he had won the California primary as a Democratic candidate, and he was 42 years old and was shot in a kitchen corridor of the Ambassador Hotel in Los Angeles by Sirhan Sirhan. So that was that was in June. Then you had the Democratic Convention happen. And then later on in the year, in October, you had black athletes raising, putting a glove on and raising a fist during the national anthem, which caused untold, I don't know, turbulence in the country, in the midst of everything else that was going on. And in December, Apollo 8 became the first manned aircraft to orbit the moon. That's just some of 1968. But this speech is a speech that you've heard snippets of. He's might be the greatest speech maker in American history. He's certainly among them. So if you've never heard it in its entirety, here's Dr. Martin Luther King. He's making a speech. He had gone to Memphis to support the sanitation workers who had requested that he come. And so this is him making this speech on the evening of April 3rd, 1968.
I was standing at the beginning of time with the possibility of taking a kind of general and panoramic view of the whole of human history up to now, and the Almighty said to me, Martin Luther King, which age would you like to live in? I would take my mental flight by Egypt. And I would watch God's children in their magnificent trek from the dark dungeons of Egypt through, or rather across the Red Sea, through the wilderness on toward the Promised Land. And in spite of its magnificence, I wouldn't stop there. I would move on by Greece and take my mind to Mount Olympus. And I would see Plato, Aristotle, Socrates, Euripides, and Aristophanes assemble around the Parthenon. And I would watch them around the Parthenon as they discussed the great and eternal issues of reality, but I wouldn't stop there. I would go on even to the great heyday of the Roman Empire. And I would see developments around there through various emperors and leaders. But I wouldn't stop there. I would even come up to the day of the Renaissance and get a quick picture of all that the Renaissance did for the cultural and aesthetic life of man, but I wouldn't stop there. I would even go by the way that the man for whom I'm named had his habitat. And I would watch Martin Luther as he tacks his 95 theses on the door at the Church of Wittenberg, but I wouldn't stop there. I would come on up even to 1863 and watch a vacillating president by the name of Abraham Lincoln finally come to the conclusion that he had to sign the Emancipation Proclamation, but I wouldn't stop there. I would even come up to the early 30s and see a man grappling with the problems of the bankruptcy of his nation and come with an eloquent cry that we have nothing to fear but fear itself, but I wouldn't stop there. Strangely enough, I would turn to the Almighty and say, if you allow me to live just a few years in the second half of the 20th century, I will be happy. Now, that's a strange statement to make because the world is all messed up. The nation is sick. Trouble is in the land. Confusion all around. That's a strange statement. But I know somehow that only when it is dark enough can you see the stars. And I see God working in this period of the 20th century in a way that men in some strange way are responding. Something is happening in our world. The masses of people are rising up, and wherever they are assembled today, whether they are in Johannesburg, South Africa, Nairobi, Kenya, Accra, Ghana, New York City, Atlanta, Georgia, Jackson, Mississippi, or Memphis, Tennessee, the cry is always the same. We want to be free. And another reason that I'm happy to live in this period is that we have been forced to a point where we are going to have to grapple with the problems that men have been trying to grapple with through history, but the demands didn't force them to do it. Survival demands that we grapple with them. Men for years now have been talking about war and peace, but now no longer can they just talk about it. It is no longer the choice between violence and nonviolence in this world. It's nonviolence or non-existence. That is where we are today. And also in the human rights revolution, if something isn't done and done in a hurry to bring the colored peoples of the world out of their long years of poverty, their long years of hurt and neglect, the whole world is doomed. Now, I'm just happy that God has allowed me to live in this period to see what is unfolding. And I'm happy that He's allowed me to be in Memphis. I can remember when Negroes were just going around, as Ralph has said so often, scratching where they didn't itch and laughing when they were not tickled. But that day is all over. We mean business now, and we are determined to gain our rightful place in God's world. And that's all this whole thing is about. We aren't engaged in any negative protest and in any negative arguments with anybody. We are saying that we are determined to be men. We are determined to be people. We are saying, that we are God's children. And if we are God's children, we don't have to live like we are forced to live. Now, what does all of this mean in this great period of history? It means that we've got to stay together. We've got to stay together and maintain unity. You know, whenever Pharaoh wanted to prolong the period of slavery in Egypt, he had a favorite formula for doing it. What was that? He kept the slaves fighting among themselves. But whenever the slaves get together, something happens in Pharaoh's court, and he cannot hold the slaves in slavery. When the slaves get together, that's the beginning of getting out of slavery. Now let us maintain unity. We aren't going to let any mace stop us. We are masters in our nonviolent movement in disarming police forces. They don't know what to do. I've seen them so often. I remember in Birmingham, Alabama, when we were in that majestic struggle there. We would move out of the 16th Street Baptist Church day after day. By the hundreds, we would move out, and Bull Connor would tell them to send the dogs for. And they did come. But we just went before the dogs singing, "Ain't gonna let nobody turn me around." Bull Connor next would say, turn the fire hoses on. And as I said to you the other night, Bull Connor didn't know history. He knew a kind of physics that somehow didn't relate to the transphysics that we knew about. And that was the fact that there was a certain kind of fire that no water could put out. And we went before the fire hoses. We had known water. If we were Baptists or some other denomination, we had been immersed. If we were Methodists and some others, we had been sprinkled, but we knew water. That couldn't stop us. And we just went on before the dogs, and we would look at them, and we'd go on before the water hoses, and we would look at it, and we'd just go on singing, over my head, I see freedom in the air. And then we would be thrown into paddy wagons, and sometimes we were stacked in there like sardines in a can. And they would throw us in, and old Bull would say, take them off. And they did, and we were just going in the paddy wagon singing, we shall overcome. And every now and then we'd get in jail, and we'd see the jailers looking through the windows, being moved by our prayer and being moved by our words and our songs. And there was a power there which Bull Connor couldn't adjust to. And so we ended up transforming Bull into a steer, and we won our struggle in Birmingham. Now let me say, as I move to my conclusion, that we've got to give ourselves to this struggle until the end. Nothing would be more tragic than to stop at this point in Memphis. We've got to see it through. When we have our march, you need to be there. If it means leaving work, if it means leaving school, be there. Be concerned about your brother. You may not be on strap, but either we go up together or we go down together. Let us develop a kind of dangerous unselfishness. One day a man came to Jesus, and he wanted to raise some questions about some vital matters of life. At points, he wanted to trick Jesus and show him that he knew a little more than Jesus knew and throw him off base. Now, that question could have easily ended up in a philosophical and theological debate. But Jesus immediately pulled that question from midair and placed it on a dangerous curve between Jerusalem and Jericho. And he talked about a certain man who fell among thieves. You remember that a Levite and a priest passed by on the other side. They didn't stop to help him. Finally, a man of another race came by. He got down from his beast, decided not to be compassionate by proxy. But he got down with him, administered first aid, and helped the man in need. Jesus ended up saying this was the good man, this was the great man, because he had the capacity to project the eye into the thou and to be concerned about his brother. Now, you know, we use our imagination a great deal to try to determine why the priest and the Levite didn't stop. At times we say they were busy going to a church meeting, an ecclesiastical gathering, and they had to get on down to Jerusalem so they wouldn't be late for their meeting. At other times, we would speculate that there was a religious law that one who was engaged in religious ceremonial was not to touch a human body 24 hours before the ceremony. And every now and then we begin to wonder whether maybe they were not going down to Jerusalem, down to Jericho rather, to organize a Jericho Road Improvement Association. That's a possibility. Maybe they felt that it was better to deal with the problem from the causal root rather than to get bogged down with an individual effect. But I'm going to tell you what my imagination tells me. It's possible that those men were afraid. You see, the Jericho Road is a dangerous road.
That's right, that's right.
I remember when Mrs. King and I were first in Jerusalem. We rented a car and drove from Jerusalem down to Jericho. And as soon as we got on that road, I said to my wife, I can see why Jesus used this as the setting for his parable. It's a winding, meandering road. It's really conducive for ambushing. You start out in Jerusalem, which is about 1,200 miles, or rather 1,200 feet above sea level. And by the time you get down to Jericho, 15 or 20 minutes later, you're about 2,200 feet below sea level. That's a dangerous road. In the days of Jesus, it came to be known as the Bloody Pass. And you know it's possible that the priest and the Levite looked over that man on the ground and wondered if the robbers were still around. Or it's possible that they felt that the man on the ground was merely faking. And he was acting like he had been robbed and hurt in order to seize them over there, lure them there for quick and easy seizure. And so the first question that the priest asked, the first question that the Levite asked was, if I stop to help this man, what will happen to me? But then the Good Samaritan came by. And he reversed the question. If I do not stop to help this man, what will happen to him? That's the question before you tonight. Not if I stop to help the sanitation workers, what will happen to my job? Not if I stop to help the sanitation workers, what will happen to all of the hours that I usually spend in my office every day and every week as a pastor? The question is not, if I stop to help this man in need, what will happen to me? The question is, if I do not stop to help the sanitation workers, what will happen to them? That's the question. Let us rise up tonight with a greater readiness. Let us stand with a greater determination, and let us move on. In these powerful days, these days of challenge, to make America what it ought to be, we have an opportunity to make America a better nation. And I want to thank God once more for allowing me to be here with you. You know, several years ago, I was in New York City autographing the first book that I had written. And while sitting there autographing books, a demented black woman came up. The only question I heard from her was, "Are you Martin Luther King?" And I was looking down writing, and I said, "Yes." The next minute, I felt something beating on my chest. Before I knew it, I had been stabbed by this demented woman. I was rushed to Harlem Hospital. It was a dark Saturday afternoon. That blade had gone through, and the x-rays revealed that the tip of the blade was on the edge of my aorta, the main artery. And once that's punctured, you're drowned in your own blood. That's the end of you. It came out in the New York Times the next morning that if I had merely sneezed, I would have died. Well, about 4 days later, they allowed me, after the operation, after my chest had been opened and the blade had been taken out, to move around in the wheelchair in the hospital. They allowed me to read some of the mail that came in, and from all over the states and the world, kind letters came in. I read a few, but one of them I will never forget. I had received one from the president and the vice president. I've forgotten what those telegrams said. I'd received a visit and a letter from the governor of New York, but I've forgotten what that letter said. But there was another letter that came from a little girl, a young girl, who was a student at the White Plains High School. And I looked at that letter, and I'll never forget it. Said simply, "Dear Dr. King, I am a ninth grade student at the White Plains High School." She said, "While it should not matter, I would like to mention that I'm a white girl. I read in the paper of your misfortune and of your suffering. And I read that if you had sneezed, you would have died. I'm simply writing you to say that I'm so happy that you didn't sneeze. And I want to say tonight, that I too am happy that I didn't sneeze, because if I had sneezed, I wouldn't have been around here in 1960 when students all over the South started sitting in at lunch counters. And I knew that as they were sitting in, they were really standing up for the best in the American dream and taking the whole nation back to those great wells of democracy which were dug deep by the founding fathers in the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution. If I had sneezed, I wouldn't have been around here in 1961 when we decided to take a ride for freedom and ended segregation in interstate travel. If I had sneezed, I wouldn't have been around here in 1962. The Negroes in Albany, Georgia decided to straighten their backs up. And whenever men and women straighten their backs up, they are going somewhere, because a man can't ride your back unless it is bent. If I had sneezed, if I had sneezed, I wouldn't have been here in 1963. The black people of Birmingham, Alabama, aroused the conscience of this nation and brought into being the Civil Rights Bill. If I had sneezed, I wouldn't have had a chance later that year in August to try to tell America about a dream that I had had. If I had sneezed, I wouldn't have been down in Selma, Alabama, to see the great movement there. If I had sneezed, I wouldn't have been in Memphis to see a community rally around those brothers and sisters who are suffering. I'm so happy that I didn't sneeze. And they were telling me, now it doesn't matter now. It really doesn't matter what happens now. I left Atlanta this morning, and as we got started on the plane, there were six of us. The pilot said over the public address system, "We are sorry for the delay, but we have Dr. Martin Luther King on the plane. and to be sure that all of the bags were checked, and to be sure that nothing would be wrong on the plane, we had to check out everything carefully, and we've had the plane protected and guarded all night. And then I got into Memphis, and some began to say the threats, or talk about the threats that were out, or what would happen to me from some of our sick white brothers. Well, I don't know what will happen now. We've got some difficult days ahead. But it really doesn't matter with me now, because I've been to the mountaintop. I don't mind. Like anybody, I would like to live a long life. Longevity has its place. But I'm not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will. And He's allowed me to go up to the mountain. And I've looked over. And I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you. But I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land. So I'm happy tonight. I'm not worried about anything. I'm not fearing any man. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord.
How about that for a speech? Pretty amazing. You sit there, and I don't know how many times I've listened to that speech over the course of the years, and every time, you know, I'm, you know, you sit here and you listen, and you know, if you just walk through the things that he talks about in the speech, you know, it's interesting. His depiction of Abraham Lincoln is extremely historically accurate, a vacillating president. If I can save the Union and free the slaves, I will do that. If I can save the Union and not free a slave, I will do that. And so my own personal opinion is Lincoln is miscast in history when he's cast as a great emancipator. He was trying to save the Union. That was his primary goal. Emancipation, if it did not line up with saving the Union, then it would have never been done. So it's interesting, a little bit of an aside, that Dr. King would present it that way. But he talks about lunch counters. He talks about, you know, so he includes in his, if he had sneezed, you know, this in his speech making, you know, the path that he takes you on, he would have never seen this, which is the way he started the speech, right? You know, if he was, if God asked him when he would like to live, you know, he talks about the pharaohs of Egypt and then goes through American history a bit. But the lunch counters, the freedom riders, the civil rights bill that LBJ signed into law, his speech on the mall in Washington, D.C., walking in Selma. So he takes you through all that, and then he takes you to Memphis, where he was that night. And so I just, every time that I listen to him, I don't know how you can be helped but blown away by his oratory skills. And then the other thing he's exhorting is, you know, if you're interested, if you've never read about, you know, Dr. King, I would suggest you do so, because honestly, it reads like fiction to think that this went on in our nation, you know, 50 to 60 years ago is when you read it, it's mind blowing, because it does read like fiction. Like, come on, this can't be true. This couldn't have happened in our country so recently. But there's a trilogy that I would recommend to you. It's called, it's written by a guy named Taylor Branch. He won a Pulitzer Prize for it. There's three volumes in it. Parting the Waters. And it deals with civil rights between 1954 and 1963. The second edition is Pillar of Fire between 1963 and 1965. And then At Canaan's Edge is the third volume in the trilogy. And then there's another, not volume in the trilogy, but another thing he wrote. It's called Bearing the Cross, and it deals with Martin Luther King and the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. And really what you see is one of the things Martin Luther King deals with on a consistent basis is the attempted fragmentation of his nonviolent movement. And not everybody was good with it. Certainly Malcolm X was not. I don't know if I would have been. Mike Musselman and I had the conversation one day, you know, how much of that would you have seen before you took up a weapon and said, hell no, not going to happen around me anymore? You know, so it's interesting to talk to your friends about, you know, were you in that situation? Would you have been part of a nonviolent movement? I don't know that I would have, or maybe I would have started out there, but I don't know that I would have been part of it for very long. And so he constantly deals with this fragmentation about people that are sick and tired of his tactic. And so he's very interesting man in American history. And I'll conclude with the way I got pointed in that direction was my daughter Colleen was going to be part of a living history thing at her elementary school, West Elementary School. I can't remember what age she was, maybe fourth grade or something like that. So we were talking, and she said, should I be Rosa Parks or should I be Martin Luther King? And I said, no, be Martin Luther King. You know, he was the real deal, man. He was the personification of that. And you'll learn more. And so she and I started kind of outlining, you know, what she, you know, things she would say at the Living Museum. And so the way the Living Museum worked was they turned the lights down in the gym. And you had all these kids standing against the wall. And if they had an exhibit, they would be next to them. And so Colleen is dressed in a black jacket with a white shirt, a black tie on, and black pants. And then she has this cutout of Martin Luther King's face. And a flashlight. So they turn and so when somebody comes and stands in front of you and they say, well, who are you? She turned the flashlight on, like all the kids did. And then she starts her little pitch. And so as she and I were doing this, I thought to myself, I said, you know what? I mean, I've seen snippets of his speeches. I grew up, during the 60s. I was a kid. And so, you know, I was certainly aware of Martin Luther King, and I remember his assassination. But I'd never really read a book about him. And so that's how I just went online and I searched for books, and I saw this was a Pulitzer Prize winner. And so I thought, well, it certainly has to be well done in order to earn that distinction. And I started reading, and honestly, it's an amazing read. And you will, the things that happen, you know, like, so you hear about the Freedom Riders, right? The Freedom Riders cross into Alabama, and they're run off the road, and the bus is set on fire, and there's guys standing outside the bus with weapons, not letting anybody off the bus. They're essentially going to burn them on the bus, except there's federal agents on the bus, and they come to the door with their pistols drawn, and then the guys outside the bus leave. So one of the buses burned, you know, there's people injured and things like that. But that's, you're like, what? Yeah, I mean, the story's crazy. Absolutely crazy. And then the bus is going to pull into the bus station. The one bus is going to pull into the bus station in Birmingham, Alabama. And the guy who runs the Ku Klux Klan tells the police chief, stay out of the bus station for 10 minutes. And he does. And so there's members of the Ku Klux Klan at the bus station. The bus comes in, and people start getting off, and they beat the hell out of them. They notice that there's a guy dressed in kind of a seersucker suit, doesn't look like he's from around here, And they're like, he's not from around here. He's with them. And his name is John Sigenthaler. His son is a reporter, I think, now for ABC News. He was working in the Kennedy administration. He was in a coma, I can't remember, for a month or something like that, because of his injuries. And so it became very personal for the Kennedys, who were reluctant to get involved in the fight for civil rights. So very interesting, very interesting. So, yeah, I would recommend it to you. 50 years ago today, Martin Luther King assassinated in Memphis, Tennessee. We'll take a quick break. General Christmas, you'll hear from him coming up next on a Wednesday edition. So our battlefield study will go back to Way. And the segment that I recorded with General Christmas was about a year and a half ago, in November of 2016. He had come on the first time, and we couldn't get to the Battle of Way because of how much stuff he'd done in his career. So he came back on to specifically talk about Huey, but it was a Wednesday. It was a day after Donald Trump's election. So I asked him about that, get his thoughts on that, and then we talked about Huey and the Tet Offensive. And then at the end, we talked about the National Museum of the Marine Corps, which General Christmas was one of the shakers and movers in terms of the concept and then the creation of it. And it's a very cool part of the interview. So don't touch that dial. All Marine Radio continues on a Wednesday, coming up next.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.